This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Malcolm X expressed the anger, bitterness, and rage felt in many African-American communities across the country in the 1960s. But whatever his tone, he clearly articulated the root causes of American racism here and abroad. Much of what he described in the 1960s is still under consideration today. Consider this observation on police brutality.
They attack the victim, and then the criminal who attacked the victim accuses the victim of attacking him.
Yes, sir.
This is American justice.
Yes, sir. That's right.
This is American democracy.
Yes, sir.
And those of you who are familiar with it,
yes,
know that in America, democracy is hypocrisy.
Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X, and Duke University and UNC Chapel Hill are hosting a two-day conference about his life and legacy. Here with me to talk about Malcolm X is Omid Safi. He is the director of the Islamic Studies Center at Duke. Welcome back, Omid. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be back.
Also with us, Jamila Karim studies race, gender, and Islam in America. She has a doctorate in Islamic studies from Duke. Jamila, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
Also with us, Sohail Dolatzai is a media and African-American studies professor at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome, Sohail. Good to have you.
Thanks for having us here, Frank.
Omid, tell us about the roots of Malcolm's activism. We'll get a little bit of his biography first. How he came to be involved with the Nation of Islam.
You know, the extraordinary thing about Brother Malcolm is that he starts so young. Even before he's formally involved with the Nation of Islam in 1950, he writes a letter to the president of the country about U.S.'s involvement in Korea, in which he says, "We're an empire, and I don't identify with our actions abroad." He identifies as a communist, and he says, "My solidarity is with people in Asia, later on with oppressed people in Africa." And he sees the suffering of his own black community being tied to the suffering of people in Asia and Africa. So this is a post-World War II context which is shaping the interrelation of racism at home and colonialism abroad.
And not purely an intellectual pursuit for him. He came to know it firsthand. His father was an outspoken critic of racism, and he experienced Malcolm X as Malcolm Little experienced it firsthand.
And I think to add on to that, I mean, I think it's important to understand that, like, you know, Malcolm didn't come out of anywhere. He didn't just drop out of nowhere. I mean, he was forged in the crucible of kind of white supremacy. But even more intimately and personally, I mean, his parents were Garveyites. Right, they were followers of the Honorable Marcus Garvey and kind of his Pan-African dream. So Malcolm grew up with these ideas as a very young boy about kind of Pan-Africanism and Pan-African unity. So I think that was kind of a really strong foundation for him that helped shape his kind of outlook later on in life.
Well, that's an important point to make because all African-Americans experienced the oppression of racism in that period. The trick was seeing yourself in the context and outside of it, to be able to sort of see yourself as part of something and not simply experience racism as the air you breathe, not to internalize it. And Jamila, one of the things that he pushed for was to give expression to that, a louder voice, using the black press as a way of reflecting this experience.
Absolutely. The legacy of the black press was the legacy of Malcolm X. He supported black newspapers. He told people to buy, African Americans to buy black newspapers, whichever they may be. And he was a fierce critic of racial hatred that was bred in the media. Also, he raised levels of black consciousness in ways that had not been done before. My mother was a member of the Nation of Islam, and before joining the Nation, though, she read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and she actually joined a Pan-Africanist group before going on to the Nation. But my mom said for the first time, when she read the autobiography, it was as though her mind was being unshackled to know that black was beautiful, that thick lips could be beautiful, that all these features that the media tells us to hate about Africa and black people, that this was all beautiful.
This was very common in the speeches he gave. Let's listen to Malcolm X in his own words.
Who taught you to hate the texture of your hair? Who taught you to hate the color of your skin to such extent that you bleach to get like the white man? Who taught you to hate the shape of your nose? and the shape of your lips? Who taught you to hate yourself from the top of your head to the soles of your feet? Who taught you to hate your own kind? Who taught you to hate the race that you belong to? So much so that you don't want to be around each other. No, before you come asking Mr. Muhammad, does he teach hate? You should ask who yourself, who taught you to hate being what God gave you.
Jamila, this certainly raises consciousness. It is a call to conscience in some ways. And at the same time, it's an indictment. People don't like to be told that they've been fooled, that they're hating themselves. And they're complicit in a way. Inherent in that is that you are complicit in your own situation. How is that received? And was that a problem for Malcolm X in African-American communities?
No, I mean, absolutely. I think that's what made the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X so appealing, was that here you have this figure who is formidably criticizing the dominant culture and the status quo. And so it was absolutely enlightening. And I think that's what pulled people in ways that one would have never imagined. I mean, the Nation of Islam is the most successful Black nationalist movement, and it persists until this day. And it was exactly that enlightening factor.
And Omid Safi, the fact that it was a nationalist movement was something that, of course, the Nation of Islam came under fierce criticism for. Why are you separating yourself? We're all one big happy family. But I think the whole project of the Nation of Islam was to shine a light on that particular hypocrisy, the lie that you are treating us differently already. Why don't we identify as
absolutely? And the fact that we were not, and I would say in some ways are not, one big happy family. Part of the genius of Malcolm, the truth of Malcolm, is to constantly be able to point out that whereas some, such as Dr. King, talked about America as a dream, Malcolm says, I experience America through the lens of its victims. And for us, it's a nightmare. And if you want us to get to the dream someday, you've got to address the reality of this suffering, which is pervasive and on the ground and in our bones.
We're talking about the legacy of Malcolm X today on The State of Things. My guest, Omid Safi, Sohail Dolatzai, and Jamila Karim, a conference on the legacy of Malcolm X, sponsored by UNC and Duke this weekend. And it's one thing to say that you've internalized this, who taught you to hate, but he also provided some answers, a clear suggestion that if you look at our history in this country, you may find some answers. Let's listen.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? What language did you speak then? What was your name? It couldn't have been Smith or Jones or Bunch or Powell. That wasn't your name. They don't have those kind of names where you and I came from. No, what was your name?
Yes, sir.
And why don't you now know what your name was then? Where did it go? Where did you lose it? Who took it? And how did he take it? What tongue did you speak? How did the man take your tongue? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? What did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
So, Sohail Dolatzai, I think this also underscores his power as a charismatic figure and as a speaker. He was able to put his finger on the pulse and also on the problem and articulate it so clearly.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not a coincidence that Malcolm, you know, resurfaces in the 80s and 90s when hip-hop culture is starting to emerge. I mean, just from that clip you just played, I mean, he has like an MC's cadence and style. But it's the substance of what he's talking about that's so striking. And I think Jamila and both Omid were getting at it. I mean, what the Nation of Islam did and why Malcolm was so powerful was they sought to kind of refashion Black identity. I mean, Malcolm is talking about the theft, not just the loss, the theft of Black history. And so hence the X, of course, right? I mean, the name change from the so-called slave master's name or the government name to the unknown. I mean, Malcolm had his name Malik al-Shabazz for a long time. But he said, even after he came back from Mecca, I will continue to go by Malcolm X as long as the conditions that created it continue to exist. The X was the unknown. And the unknown was a kind of wake-up call, not just to Black people, but to white America about what kind of suffering black people have had to endure and how we're trying to excavate a kind of past. So conversion to Islam became that kind of an excavation. It was about who we were. They called it, you know, our original name was their Arabic name. You know, Islam was the black man's religion, right? It's who we were before we were brought here as slaves. So all of this stuff is going on, and Malcolm is really like, Malcolm's a historian at the same time as he's a strategist and a tactician and a motivator. And I think that's what makes him so brilliant.
But I mean, Safi, the difference between Malcolm X's emphasis on the current situation and Dr. King's dream of where we could be if things worked out better had a polarizing effect on the movement initially, right? We have to acknowledge that.
Absolutely. I think the two of them certainly had distinctions in their approach, in their cadence, in the symbols that they reference. King eventually moves much closer to Malcolm. In the beginning, he keeps wanting to say that there's this American dream and all men, one would hope today he would have said all women as well, are created equal. Malcolm can't help but start from the point of we're not equal. We're not treated as equal. Whereas most of us keep looking at Martin through the lens of I Have a Dream speech, very few people keep walking with Martin to where he ends up, where 4 years after that, Martin goes on national TV and says, I might have been too idealistic about the dream. I might have spoken too soon. I realize that America is also a nightmare. It's as if he's channeling Malcolm now. So I really do see this convergence between the later Martin and many of the teachings of Malcolm.
We'll talk more about that as our conversation about the legacy of Malcolm X continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking about civil rights leader Malcolm X, 50 years after his assassination. Omid Safi is with me, director of Islamic Studies Center at Duke University. Jamila Karim studies race, gender, and Islam in America. Sohail Dolatzai is a media and African-American studies professor at the University of California at Irvine. Jamila, you were talking about your mother being attracted to the Nation of Islam, and having read the autobiography of Malcolm X, he did speak about women. And, of course, when we think about Islam, the question of women's role and their place in Islam is important. What was his position? How did he frame the Nation of Islam with regard to women?
Right. For Malcolm X and for the Nation of Islam generally, the gender ideology was that men were the protectors, defenders, and providers of women. And women were homemakers. And often the Nation of Islam is criticized for this gender ideology as not progressive. But it really resonated with African-American women who had a history of sexual assault, systematic rape against them since enslavement. And then post-slavery, African-American women had a tradition of working as domestics in white homes. And so the idea of being protected and also being provided for, given the economic hardship and the racial effects of class that African Americans experience, that all of this gender ideology was quite compelling.
Let's hear Malcolm X on that subject.
The most disrespected person in America is the black woman. The most unprotected person in America is the black woman. The most neglected person in America is the black woman. And as Muslims, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us to respect our women and to protect our women. And the only time a Muslim really gets real violent is when someone goes to molest his woman. We will kill you for our woman. I'm making it plain, yes. We will kill you for our woman. We believe that if the white man will do whatever is necessary to see that his woman gets respect and protection, then you and I will never be recognized as men until we stand up like men and place the same penalty over the head of anyone who puts his filthy hands out to put in the direction of our women.
Jamila Kareem, that does not sound terribly progressive from a feminist point of view. Women who need protection, a kind of infantilization. You can read it that way in that context. It also rings of the very provocation for lynching, which began around the turn of the 20th century, this idea that we white men must protect our women. Heard with this historical distance, how do you place that in context?
Well, again, I think the context is that, in a sense, there's this critique of the dominant racial order, and that you've had this systematic way of exploiting our women. And the way that Malcolm X, he fought back was to say that we also will defend our women. The reality was that he was bringing attention to what had been done to African-American women through white racism.
And this, I guess, Omid Safi, again, gets back to this, our condition now. Here's where we are now and what will resonate with us now versus, and I suppose at the same time, maybe this is the time to talk about this convergence, he and Martin Luther King. I mean, any prophet has, it seems to me, two missions. One is to call attention to the conditions today, but also, secondly, a true prophet has to create the vision of that new place, where we're going. It's not just about how awful it is here. And so maybe the two of them together in some ways provide a better context for understanding this.
Absolutely. I think, as you know, a lot of us know and recall Brother Martin being shot in Lorraine Motel in Memphis. We remember that the Sunday after he was killed, he was supposedly going to deliver a sermon called, and I quote, "Why America May Go to Hell." And that notion of the fact that the soul of America is not doing well, that we are suffering from not just individual, but structural, institutional, and systematic models of oppression and exploitation and racism. And I think this is where Malcolm's voice is so important for us. He keeps talking about, it's not just about how nice you are to me. It's about the structures and institutions that are set up in society, which themselves are exploitative and oppressive.
And it was toward the very end of his career that Martin Luther King spoke openly about this, about institutional inequalities, in a very famous speech where he talked about his opposition to the Vietnam War, a controversial position for Dr. King.
I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered.
And, you know, let's just take a look at where we are now. I mean, racism is still with us. Ferguson is with us. Michael Brown, Trayvon Martin, police brutality. You talk about materialism. We've got 1% of this country owning 42% of the wealth. We got 20% of our babies living in poverty. 40% of our black babies, brown babies, Native American babies living in poverty. The most vulnerable people in our society. And you talk about militarism, and we don't have money for decent public schools, we don't have enough money for decent public housing to take care of our elderly, of our children, of our environment, but somehow magically, poof, we can make money appear for these endless wars overseas.
So, Hale, these are themes that are being expressed abroad in popular culture, certainly in hip-hop culture, not only in Muslim communities.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important to think about Malcolm in this context. I mean, I think we have to understand the kind of ground or the very fertile soil of racism that kind of sprouted Malcolm. But it's also important not to see him simply in an American context. I mean, Malcolm, his fundamental project was to kind of imagine black people not as a national minority, but as part of a global majority. And you hear in King's speech, his Beyond Vietnam speech, is a call for America. He says we need to think beyond the nation. Right. And he says, you know, America must listen to those it calls enemy. And if we were to fast forward to today, America must listen to those it calls terrorists. They might have something to say about what America is doing, right, in those parts of the world. And so I think it's important to understand that backdrop. And clearly, I think Malcolm reemerges, as I mentioned before, in popular culture, particularly in hip-hop, at a particular moment when the hyper-nationalism of Reagan and Bush through the war on crime sought to kind of like, you know, as has always been the project in America. I mean, America is like obsessed with trying to have black people identify as Americans. It redeems America. It suggests a kind of overcoming of the scar of slavery and the wound that slavery is. And so black people identifying as Americans is kind of like a dream that the United States constantly has. And Malcolm sought to kind of push through. And in hip hop in the 80s and 90s with the hyper-nationalism of Reagan, you heard artists trying to break through. So Rakim writes a song called Casualties of War, where he writes in the perspective of a U.S. soldier in Iraq during the first Gulf War. And he, you know, ends up shooting his sergeant because he asks, what am I here for? Who's on the other side of the wall, right? So there's some real fundamental things that were happening in hip-hop culture that were seeking to challenge kind of the hyper-nationalism of Reagan and Bush. And Malcolm, you know, is the most sampled voice in hip-hop culture.
That's interesting. And we actually have a clip here from, as you say, there are many artists who could provide examples. We'll listen to Brother Ali from 2012, and he starts with a quote from Malcolm X.
I don't usually deal with those big words because I don't usually deal with big people. When it's in the verse, it ain't wrong no more. Cause warfare to terrorism of the rich. Who's a true gorilla when the powder's on your body? Killing innocent civilians, but a life is a life, and a killer is a killer. You had a test chiller, push a button, kill a million.
Brother Ali reprising the quotes from Malcolm X.
Absolutely. I was actually with Ali at an event in Princeton where we were talking about Malcolm. And he's a beautiful, beautiful brother. Shout out to Brother Ali. But Malcolm, again, was sampled at the beginning of his song, but Malcolm was continually sampled throughout hip hop. And it's important to understand, I mean, Ali's getting at some real fundamental questions. You know, it's like Dr. King said, violence was the language of the unheard, right? And it's important for us to understand, you know, what that means in the contemporary moment, right? The language of the unheard, and what is the response? That at the end of the day, it's a very kind of existential question that needs to be asked. Like, how much are a people supposed to endure, right?
Well, it gets back to that quote that we had at the very beginning of our program, where Malcolm X shines a light on exactly what police brutality is. First, you provoke violence. Then when the African-American man or whoever you have under your club responds, then they're resisting arrest and you beat them silly, and it gets played out over and over again. So if you keep launching missiles into innocent quarters in Pakistan and Afghanistan, if you kill tens of thousands of people in the wars in Iraq, innocent people in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and then don't expect a response, even if it is produced by an envy of people who envy your power and then reproduce your violence, and you look at ISIS and say, there's something wrong with them, they're reproducing American violence. Right. And so that's a little bit of what, and of course it shows up in pop culture, not only in Muslim communities.
Absolutely. Right? Not just in Muslim communities. I mean, I think that we have to understand that it's not just Muslims who are subject to American imperial violence. And when we think about that kind of, you know, I mean, and I think Malcolm was getting at it, like, it's like today we talk about extremists, right? Well, what's an extremist? It's a relative term, like, you know, and it assumes that there's some sort of like normative or center, invisible center. But what Malcolm was getting at was like, well, wait a minute. You know, what about this center is so normal? Why don't we see white supremacy and capitalism and patriarchy as extreme? Yet our response to these very violent forces are called extreme. Right. And Malcolm was calling out that contradiction.
It's also important to point out that on his Hajj, when he went to Mecca to explore or to get a better understanding of Islam, he came back with a quote about seeing people with blonde hair and blue eyes who he could identify with. So in many ways, this convergence was not only Dr. King understanding that he had to stand on his ground today in order to project into a future, but also Malcolm X understanding that if this was a a global movement, it included people of all races.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we want to put aside this notion of either Martin or Malcolm somehow being these post-racial figures that some conservatives would like to project. But Malcolm does come back with this quote that he says, America needs to understand Islam because this is the one religion that erases from its society the race problem. And I would argue that real Christianity, real Judaism, any of these traditions that are really tapped into the twin fountains of love and justice can do that same thing. But for Malcolm, it's Islam that continues part of his evolution. But he keeps saying, I'm still a black nationalist freedom fighter.
Well, the words are provocative because they keep shining a light on this persistent injustice. And we can talk about the contemporary examples today. But I'm just reminded of Adolf Reed's quote in Harper's just recently, where he, you know, talks about, I mean, he's talking about the election of Barack Obama. And it's just this thing. He says it's a triumph. The Barack Obama's election is a triumph of identity as content. Obama embodies race as an abstraction, a feel-good evocation severed from history and social relations, unquote. So the idea that we're post-racial, that somehow we can't, that these things aren't relevant anymore, it seems to me in some ways preposterous.
Sure. I mean that was kind of the fear around Obama too, right? Was he was this closet Muslim.
Right.
I talk about it in my book, right?
Yeah.
And that, to me, that fear, what I argued in the book, was this fear of blackness and Islam is really a deeper-seated anxiety over Malcolm. This connection of blackness to Islam is a deep-seated anxiety within the American imagination. And I think, as Omid was talking about, like, you know, Malcolm didn't come back a universalist. I mean, there's a sense that, to be a universalist is to be colorblind. Malcolm came back from Mecca, and he was before Mecca, but even more so after, an internationalist, you know. And he said, like, I'm still black in America. We have to work through the structures of white supremacy in order to get to this ideal that we talk about.
Right. Yeah, and I find it fascinating, and I wrote my first book about, too, how Muslims still must live up to that ideal. And especially given that the majority of Muslims in the United States are African-American and those coming from immigrant backgrounds. So even as a community, it's something that we're still working towards.
Can Malcolm X exist today? Could that figure be a notable and expressive figure in today's culture?
I mean, I think absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one thing that Malcolm failed, what Malcolm had a lot of was courage. And I think that's what we need to have today is the people who have the courage to speak out. I mean, you know, the White House is holding its countering violent extremism hearings, you know, and Islam is specifically targeted as the source of this, right? Without understanding how structurally violent extremism is woven through the American fabric, right? The empire is extreme. And so we need people in the tradition and spirit of Malcolm and King and Fannie Lou Hamer and Angela Davis and a whole host of others to be able to speak out against those structures and those conditions. So absolutely. I mean, the hope is another Malcolm would emerge. I'm not much into like leaders per se. Leaders, as like in the case of Malcolm, can get killed, and then what do we do?
Right. Well, I mean, that's the question. Why aren't there figures like that today? Is the example of that assassination, and so to be successful, you don't talk that way, and maybe you make it to the White House. If you do talk that way,
right.
you don't leave the ballroom.
Right. Right. I mean, yeah.
And I think the key is to let go of the messianic delusion that one Martin, one Malcolm is going to come and redeem us. This is what Ella Baker kept telling us. People kept asking her, you know, when's the Malcolm that Martin made the movement? And Ella would always shout back, the movement made Martin. I think if there is a path forward for us, it's for people who are going to invest in creating movements of solidarity that are grounded, that are authentic, that are real, and eventually, periodically, these gigantic leaders that echo back to the community truths that we already know to be true in our bones. They're just saying to us what we already know.
You see that with Palestine and Gaza, and then, sorry, the Gaza-Ferguson kind of solidarity, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so you see those kind of international solidarities that King and Malcolm and many others were about being forged today already.
Yeah, and I think I agree that we are collectively walking in Malcolm X's legacy. And one woman that's notable for me is the late peace advocate Taiba Taylor, who started the magazine Aziza, a magazine by and for Muslim women. And she was walking in Malcolm's legacy of creating an alternate press. And what she did was she transformed this symbol and image of the Muslim woman in the media is presented as a press to a woman who is confident, intelligent, proud to be Muslim, proud to be American. And I think that way of resisting the dominant media is especially relevant given the tragedy that occurred in Chapel Hill last week.
If you think about that, the idea of white rage is abroad, Islamophobia, all of these issues, not to mention gun ownership and the way every household in America, or many, have become arsenals, guns that are licensed to angry men in many cases. Where does the legacy of Malcolm X, is it any part of this? Is this story any part of the legacy of Malcolm X?
I would say so. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, obviously there's a lot of pressure to put on the authorities to call this a hate crime and whatnot. I think it's important. I mean, had this happened, and it did happen back in the 50s and 60s when a church in Alabama was bombed and four little girls were killed. I mean, this was seen as not just a lone individual act. This was seen as an extension of state violence. And so what I think it's important for us to understand is when what happened in Chapel Hill happened, this is an extension of state violence, right? White rage and its kind of projection upon non-white bodies, these racial others who are deemed as threatening to their livelihoods, is an extension of state violence. And I think that's the deeper, kind of more penetrating insight that we have to bring to bear on our politics when it comes to this.
And of course, we don't have a criminal justice system that can put any of that on trial or has any way to screen that kind of evidence, right?
Absolutely. And I think this is where, again, the voice of Malcolm is speaking to us when he says, if you're not careful, the newspapers and by extension media is going to have you hating the people who are being oppressed, loving the people who are doing the oppressing. The question that we got to keep asking, just as Dr. King told us, not just focus on the individual act, but focus on the system that's producing the hate that makes violence possible.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Omid Safi, Director of the Islamic Studies Center at Duke University. Sohail Dolatzai, a Media and African American Studies Professor at University of California, Irvine, and Jamila Karim, an independent scholar who studies race, gender, and Islam in America. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you for listening. There's more information on our website, thestateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Josh Oliver. Stay tuned.